Steve Martin's latest novel, An Object of Beauty, takes place in the New York City art scene of the 1990s. Lacey Yeager, his protagonist, is the kind of woman who's clear-headed enough to recognize her assets and dispassionate enough to use them to forward her ambitions. Mr. Martin was on our show in November to discuss his book, which, unlike most novels, includes 22 full-color illustrations. We thought we would re-air it for you today. I started off by pointing out that while he had written a play about Picasso and now a novel about an art gallery owner, he hasn't written a novel about acting in films, being a comedian, or being a banjo player. So I asked Steve Martin, is the art world where your imagination is set these days?
I've always been fascinated with the art world. By the way, I did write a memoir, so that included all those. But since the late 60s, I've been completely fascinated with the art world and paintings. I sort of separate those two. There's the artistic side of things, and then there's the art world side of things. And, the arts is filled with aesthetics and beauty and discussion of the higher planes of what art means. And by the way, so is the art world. But the art world also includes finance and theft and trades and fakes and provenance.
And without her eye and feeling for art, would Lacey's ambitions have led her to investment banking?
I think Lacey liked the action. There's a passage in the book that sort of differentiates the world of Sotheby's and Wall Street. And Sotheby's just feels like glamour and international money, although Wall Street has international money too. But that there was something else, something very exciting going on. And I think when you go to a function where there's art involved, the people are generally, and I know I'm making a generalization that's going to get me in trouble, a little more fun when they're in the arts, a little more trouble.
Early on, Lacey reframes a painting and has it superficially cleaned before its auction and through that raises its price significantly.
Well,
so it's the frame plays a role.
And cleaning often helps a picture because, they sit in houses over fireplaces and they collect soot, and people in those days were smoking and putting layers of tar over pictures. So they do brighten up.
And then we have fights over whether the cleaning of the Sistine Chapel gives us what Michelangelo or Michelangelo, as some of my listeners insist I say, really intended, or whether it has destroyed his vision.
Well, you have to be very, very careful cleaning those pictures. That's a very Peter Sheldahl has a fantastic article in the New Yorker this week about the Ghent altarpiece by Van Eyck, and that shows you the complications of cleaning and restoring old masters.
That painting has been cleaned recently.
They're actually restoring it now and just trying to decide what to do. If they'd only asked me, I could have told them.
That's an oil painting.
Brillo.
I see.
Brillo and some soap.
How does Lacey come to art? Is it love that brings her or opportunity?
I think that in looking at my own past, and as the author I'm allowed to, I was just fascinated with it. It's a very romantic calling. When I was, in my 20s, that would have been about 1965, and that's when pop art was making news, and that's all you heard about. And it was also only really 10 years, at least news-wise, from the explosion of abstract expressionism. So it was. And you heard the names Jackson Pollock and Rothko, and then suddenly there's Roy Lichtenstein and Andy Warhol, and all this was
Jasper Johns and Robert Rauschenberg,
and it was very exciting. And I was living in Orange County, California, for that news to travel that far. It was very important, and I was a romantic college student, so I became just romantically involved with the art world, and I do think that's why my character. In the book, Lacey Yeager and her friend Daniel Franks just were interested from the beginning. And, of course, the young narrator, is started as many art writers do. They want to be an artist. They recognize they don't have the talent for it, and they become art writers.
When did you start collecting? How old were you?
I was about 21.
So that 22. Early, your career hadn't really taken off yet, had it?
No. Well, I was hired very young to write for the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour, and I got very lucky because there was writers union, and so I went from earning nothing to earning minimum wage for a writer, which was for a 21-year-old was enormous.
And what was the first thing you bought?
Well, it's vague, but I'll for the sake of being exciting, I'll say it was an Ed Ruscha print of Hollywood, the Hollywood sign.
And that's in this book.
No.
There is an Ed Ruscha in this book.
Yeah, there is an Ed Ruscha in the book, but that's the Los Angeles County Museum on fire.
You, were you buying the stuff that you liked or stuff that galleries were suggesting would be good investments?
There was no such thing as an investment. No, I only bought things that I liked and didn't know there was another way. I bought antique store paintings, 19th century paintings, American paintings. So that's what I was mainly interested in.
You say that paintings for collectors are transformed into things that healed.
Well, there's a passage in the book where I try to explain, you know, I attempt a lot in the book, and one is to reveal what this lust is, what this romance is that, sorry to keep using that word, but that is that Lacey understands that the desire for these pictures or for these things that people have is multi-layered. Sometimes it's intellectual, sometimes it's aesthetic. But at the root of it is some kind of desire to heal oneself, that you feel that this object is going to complete your life in some way. Now, I think a lot of collectors understand that it's only temporary and that there will be another object that will come along that is going to make you feel whole.
Well, she's not the most romantic person in the world, but she plays on that sense of romance.
Well, she has a lust for life. I think that's what she's playing on. She's very ambitious, and I count that as a lust for life. And she does learn about paintings, and she is operating she has a moment, for example, in her with a Milton Avery painting, and it's, you know, she's been down in the bins at Sotheby's cataloging paintings and just doing cataloging work. And she's supposed to deliver this Milton Avery painting to Washington, D.C., but she gets waylaid along the way, and she has to take the painting home to her little downtown apartment. And she thinks, well, while I'm here, I'll just hang it. And so here is this sort of fantastic object in her student's apartment, and she's alone with it, and she has a drink, and she suddenly finds herself communing with it. And she has a moment, an epiphany of why people want these things. And she decides to change her life and to upgrade her life in a sense. And she understands why people want them. And then her life changes.
Is this a sort of a novel that you have to do a lot of research for?
No,
you've been in part of the world. But I'm sure you spoke to gallery owners because to some degree, you also deal with the inner workings of the business.
Well, I knew a lot of it. As I say, I've been involved in the art world for, I guess, 40 years, and I try to make a book like this when you're dealing with, you might consider an esoteric subject, but art is not really an esoteric subject. People know something about it. They've usually been to a museum. I try to explain it along the way in careful language.
Well, it's not just about art. It's about somebody
right,
who has great
character.
Ambition.
Right.
She is somebody who, if I want to be crass, would sleep her way up the ladder.
Well, as I say in the book, she's not a person who sleeps her way to get advantage. It's the promise of sex that she uses, but never sex itself.
She, unlike most women, even ambitious ones, doesn't really seem to crave a deep personal relationship. It's success.
The man she ends up with, as she explains to the narrator, who's her friend, says, oh, it's a perfect relationship. He doesn't love me too much.
She also, you say, doesn't see herself as having equals.
Yes.
I mean, when I say you say, this is what is being written in the book,
right,
obviously.
Right, of course. Yeah.
And this is fiction. So maybe I should say someone says.
It's the narrator saying, right, that she never views anyone as her peer. She knows who's above her, and she knows who is below her, but she never views anyone as an equal.
And
she's always moving up.
And you do see that happening a lot in the art world, maybe in other worlds as well, where people are very aware of who is the next step, represents the next step, and who you've passed.
Right.
Artists think that way as well.
Right. I think it's you know, the art world, obviously, this could happen in any world, finance, certainly show business. She is the kind of person whose job it is in her head to go into a room and light it up.
Would this be the sort of thing that you would see in the movie world, for example?
Definitely.
For a while I was thinking of the Barbara Stanwyck movies of the past, but Barbara Stanwyck always gets her comeuppance because that's the way the movies were, and you had to end with somebody paying for her sins.
Well, any field that where personality is an asset, and certainly show business, certainly sales, any kind of sales, except I guess in finance, I guess they want you probably want your broker to be very dull. If they're too exciting, you worry a little bit. Why so flip with my money?
My guest is Steve Martin, it's weird saying this. His latest novel is An Object of Beauty, and the book is published by Grand Central. Your third novel?
Yes. Qualify as novellas, and this is my first full-length novel.
And is this when did you realize that you weren't satisfied enough simply by being one of the most popular entertainers in America?
Well, thank you. I've been writing my whole life. I was writing for television, and then I wrote screenplays. And then I got into prose really in the late 80s when I started writing for The New Yorker. Mm-hmm. And then I wrote
But amusing pieces. This is not a funny book.
Yes, right. And then I started writing I wrote a couple of plays, and then I really started writing prose around the early 90s. So I've been writing prose at least for 25 years.
One of the things that you deal with here is what makes a painting valuable or less valuable.
Yes, I do deal with that. And that's a fairly easy thing to explain, at least when I have time to write it down. I don't know if I could do it right now. But what is harder, and I do go at it in the book too, is what makes a painting aesthetic? What makes a painting better than another painting? And really, Lacey acquires that, and she acquires it by looking at hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of paintings, and by listening to people who know about things talk about them, and she starts to learn why one Picasso is better than another. As I say in the book, I can't quote it exactly, but she finally begins to understand why one Picasso warrants a wow and other ones get a dismissive, sneer.
Although they're all worth a lot more than another painter's best work.
Yes, absolutely.
Because they're Picasso.
Especially mine.
You paint on the
side? No, I don't. I'm terrible.
Well, you seem to suggest Moonlight on the Water could be a major factor.
Yeah.
But, this whole thing changes. Artists who were once ignored suddenly become really
absolutely
important. And even within my own lifetime, I can think of some artists who were really hot 20 years ago who have pretty much disappeared.
Well, this is a lesson of history, too. I mean, Vermeer was not really known as a great, great artist until the late 19th, early 20th century. We all know the story of Van Gogh was not really discovered until after his death. He was known, but he was not collected significantly.
And Raphael was considered the greatest artist that ever lived for a long time. Now, I don't think anybody would make that claim. He's a
well,
great
I think
artist.
He's still considered a great artist. But there are some great discoveries, you know, made artists of his period that are considered great.
But in the world of the art gallery world, this is very important because an artist who's on his or her way up is somebody you want to sign, somebody who may be on the way down you might want to get rid of. Mm-hmm. It becomes very less about aesthetics and more about something else. So the zeitgeist, perhaps.
Well, that's right. I talk in the book about the time before this time when it took more than, you know, a year or two for the art world to decide who was a genius. And, you know, the last people, I think, who were that took time were the pop artists, that it really did take about 25 years for them to really become fixed, although they were always collectible and always valuable, to become fixed as really important artists. It did take about 20, 25 years. And I must say that some artists who may be fixed in history maybe took them about 10, 15 years, but you really don't know for 50, 60, 70 years who's going to be around.
Some collectors specialize. Edward G. Robinson, Impressionist,
Great
Vincent
impressionist
Price, Impressionist.
Collector.
You seem to be all over the place.
sorry. My eye has strayed. I started collecting 19th
Does
century American.
Your wife know about this?
I had 19th century American with the Hudson River painters. Then I sort of moved up and I started looking at earlier American modernists, O'Keeffe and Sheeler and Dove. And then I started looking at the abstract expressionists and then pop. And then I started looking at, I just had a wide ranging interest for some reason. And I do have, like I say, just a roving eye when it comes to art.
Well, you've always had a strong visual sense. When you came upon the scene, when you're doing stand-up, you had that white outfit that you used to wear, the white linen outfit, which distinguished you from other people who were trying to establish themselves. Was that something that – I'm assuming that's something you did very consciously.
Well, it didn't have much to do with paintings. It really had to do with a book that I read when I was a young magician, and it equated a stage show to an opera. It said an opera uses everything. It uses the visual, it uses the voice, it uses sound, it uses drama, it uses comedy. And I thought, that's what I've got to do. I've got to cover, blanket the stage and have everything going on.
My guest is Steve Martin. His latest novel is An Object of Beauty, published by Grand Central. There's a scene in which Lacey meets John Updike on a train to Washington, and he asks her how rich people know so much about art. I remember from when I was very young, I met this woman who was quite very wealthy, a young woman, and I didn't think she was all that bright. And we got talking about art, and she knew everything that I knew about contemporary art. And I asked her, how did she know about this? She said, well, we have a de Kooning and a Franz Kline on the wall. There is also just access, isn't there?
It is very strange to me. I mean, that a magnificent painting brings a high price means, well, somebody very rich knew that that was a great painting. And it's always puzzled me a little bit. And first of all, that scene with John Updike on the train is there because, you know, John. Not a lot of people know that John Updike wrote a lot about, especially, American painting.
Well, first he tried to establish himself as an artist. He did cartoons.
Oh, I didn't know that. Well, I don't know everything, I guess.
Well,
should I leave?
John Updike came here to talk about art a number of times, among other things. So.
And he published books of art criticism, on especially American painting, Hopper, and especially early 20th century American painting.
Had you met him?
No, I never did.
So this was just something from your imagination?
Yeah, I kind of wanted to get across. It was a nice little scene. So he asked the question, and it always has kind of puzzled me because I know a lot of rich people, and they have incredible taste. But since then, I've learned that not all rich people have incredible taste.
But then there are people like Ronald Lauder who just has a collection.
Fantastic paintings.
Yeah, one great painting after another. And I remember asking a well-known artist about that. I said, well, he must have great advice. He said, a lot of people get great advice, but there's something else there.
Yes.
You don't buy that many great works of art without knowing
you'd
something.
Be surprised. That doesn't look like a collection of advice.
Yeah.
I've seen that collection, and it's you can tell by the way he talks about the way he looks at them. He knows those paintings. George Soros has a great collection of paintings.
Does Glenn Beck know that? Very early on in the book, Lacey buys a painting from one gallery without using cash and then sells it to another for a profit. That sounds like something that somebody in the on Wall Street might do.
Well, that just shows her ingenuity. And
that's arbitrage, isn't it?
Well, if I should have my dictionary. But, that's very possible in the art world, and it was especially possible – especially possible in sort of that 19th century American art world where, there's a thing in the art world called runners. And runners are people who can actually spot a painting at one gallery and think, I know this other gallery that will be interested in that painting. And they can sort of acquire it with a transparency or something without ever investing any money. And they essentially run that painting up to another gallery and sell it to them. And they make $500 for doing it.
I was surprised and delighted by the small but very fine illustrations of paintings that are discussed in the book. What made you decide to include illustrations?
I'll tell you. As I was writing, the painting by Ed Ruscha, L.A. County Museum on Fire, became a crucial painting plot-wise. And the description of it, I was describing it, but I really wanted the reader to see it. So just for the heck of it, when you're writing on a computer, you can just drop it in. So I just dropped it in, and I thought, gee, that's kind of interesting, because I was writing about a lot of paintings, and I didn't want to just spend time going, and the sea is in the left, and it's blue, and just going on with trying to describe it, because I really wanted to talk about the paintings in a different way. I didn't want to waste sentences describing it that may or may not land. So I started dropping these paintings in my computer. And when I sold the book to the publisher, I said, I want these paintings in the book in color, and I want them to land when they're being discussed, not in a centerfold, that the reader, if you're like me, immediately gets the book and then looks at all the looks at all the pictures right away at the center of the book, which kind of ruins the book.
And the comments that the author has appended to those pictures.
Yeah.
So that's what it's about. Well, there's this whole dialogue between the real world and your invented world in this book, including real characters, Peter Sheldahl, the dealer, Larry Gagosian. And then you have some invented artists. It must have been fun coming up with them. I'm assuming that the artist you call Pilot Mouse is based on Banksy.
Well, it's not really, but he's like Banksy in that he kind of starts as a graffiti artist, and that's where the similarity ends. The reason I blended real people with fictional characters, it was twofold. One, I couldn't have an auction house called Ferguson's. People, it had to be Sotheby's and Christie's. And if you're writing a book about the art world in the 90s and the aughts, you can't not mention Larry Gagosian and Aquavella and all the downtown galleries. It would sound just fake, for one thing. And
you can't put it in Tribeca when it's in Chelsea.
Right. Well, I'd be allowed to use the name Chelsea. But I also didn't want the book to come off as a Romana Clay and say, oh, who's that supposed to be? Is that Larry Gagosian? Mm-hmm. And say, no, I didn't want a guessing game to be played. So that's why it actually took me a while to figure this out, believe it or not. I wanted to include the real people so fictional characters wouldn't be mistaken for them.
Just a moment on your other career. Mm-hmm. Your next movie is The Big Year.
Yes. The Big Year is a movie based on a nonfiction book called The Big Year, and it's starring myself and Jack Black and Owen Wilson, and it's a very fine film. And it's about competitive bird watching.
I think we had the author on.
Oh, good.
When the book first came out,
I'm in love with the film, and as a matter of fact, I have a a song that I wrote as part of the soundtrack. The Big Year. No, it's a banjo song.
Well, you didn't bring a banjo. I'm so disappointed.
Sorry.
Well, in the old days, everything in Hollywood was shot in the back lot. I suspect
this is on location.
You had to do this all on location.
Yes, we went to the Yukon. We went to the Canadian desert. We went to the ocean on a big seasick-making ship. We saw eagles. It was great. Really great fun.
And when is it coming out?
I don't know.
Ah.
Yeah. It'll be next year sometime.
Meanwhile, we are going out with a cut from your CD, The Crew.
The Crow.
The Crow. The Crew. The Crow. Oh, yes.
The Crew is my yes. another album.
Well, I was hoping that it would be The Big Year. But the book is An Object of Beauty, and it is published by Grand Central Publishing. And my great thanks to Steve Martin
Thank
for
you.
Coming by and talking about it with us.
Thank you.